The Westwood One Podcast Network.
Never quit radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ Podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit Podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup. Hello there, Team Never Quit Nation. Welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit Podcast. My name's Andrew, joined by Marcus, joined by Morgan.
What's up, brother?
What's up, guys? We're excited to have Chris Duffin on today's show. This guy is insane.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear this.
Co-owner, coach of Kabuki Strength Lab, and a Guinness World Record holder for the most weight deadlifted in 1 minute.
And apparently he's got the most craziest childhood story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the craziest, but it's not something you wouldn't expect it. I didn't see that coming. Blindside.
Yeah, I mean, I read his story before we interviewed him, but it didn't get into what he gets into today. So You're gonna love it. Patreon question of the day comes from Nathan, and he asks for Marcus and Morgan, 1911 versus the Glock, please, for the love of God, in the debate. Yes, I know, probably won't, but let's give it a shot.
There's a reason why there's multiple different guns made, and there's a right.
It is all about user preference. However, I'm going to beat Glock up, because the Glock representative showed up with the team one day to try to pitch it to us. And in a community, we carried SIGs. I prefer 1911 over Glock. And I'm going to tell you why I don't like Glocks. Because he was going through the weapon system and how user-friendly it is. And I was in the back of the class, and I raised my hand. And I was like, sir, if you come off a dive in 39-degree water after 6 hours, and there's a weapon malfunction in that system, can you break it down? And you can't, because of the detent, the breakdown pins are so small.
Freaking handshake.
It's an acute movement. And you can't, oh, just terrible. I've never been a Glock fan since then.
They train us out of, it's not that we're not Glock fans, it's just like we don't use those for that particular reason.
And no, I'm not a Glock fan.
Well, yeah.
I like a hammer. I like a decocking lever.
We don't do those fine motor, like everything with us is big.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to a pistol, you're in, you know. It's bad.
Not for the average user, someone who's never going to come out of a dive to use either of these firearm systems. Is there one that?
Hey, gonna use so that thing.
Hey, look.
There's everything. It's when we'd go through this, man. Someone's like, "Hey, what's the best pistol?" I was like, "Go down to the range, get everyone they got in different calibers, because your hands are different, fit different." I mean,
but you remember, just the Glock itself, it doesn't have the hammer, it doesn't have the safety mechanism, it doesn't have the dual safety with the webbing plus the, like, that idiot that fired that Glock off in his pants next to us.
That was a good one.
Okay. With a 1911, you have to grab a hold of the weapon. So for a very experienced shooter, okay, I can understand, you know, either way. But for someone just that is unfamiliar or not an expert shooter in handling a weapon system, 1911s are much safer. As well.
Yeah.
I think it's been around forever.
It's true.
For a while, anyways.
But like you said, every gun is really, I mean, in some ways, there's safety features, obviously, in different guns. They're going to be different. But
I think I've got 30 pistols, and I still haven't found one I like.
Yeah, there's going to be a personal preference. Like, I don't even like my concealed handgun.
Well, I don't think you're supposed to get to like your gun that much. Hey.
No, but
I was like, you spent too much time with it.
Look what daddy did get.
Yeah.
What'd you get?
Head to toe. A new Kimber 357 pistol.
Nice.
Why is it gangsters always? Why don't gangsters use holsters?
Is it a joke?
Why? No, I mean, I just watch TV and I always notice that cops use holsters and gangsters don't. So they'll know the difference? There's some dudes putting them big old 50s
right in there.
50s right in the front of their pants. But like, I would, yeah.
Quick accessibility. I don't know.
I mean,
there's that guy on YouTube.
Holsters are uncomfortable though.
Yeah. I bought this wheel gun. I mean, I couldn't hit you from here.
Dad used to have a nightmare about that. Remember?
With it.
That 38 yeah, special.
I had that same nightmare.
Figures.
It's more of just this thing recurring. Is so loud.
It's loud.
Like, when it goes off, it's just a deterrent so I can run.
Hey, just, I'll just fire blank rounds out. I think it's damn loud.
1911. Go with that.
Now, he gave you only two options.
I know. SIG.
SIG?
That's my preference. It's a toss-up between Kimber and SIG, but since I use SIG in the military, that was my fallback.
I like a Kimber.
I like them both. I got both of them.
Yeah.
I got all four of them.
Yeah. I don't carry one in the water. I don't carry one in a. Yeah. It depends on. That's why you have multiple. Yeah. It depends on what you're going to do.
I can't carry my other gun when I'm wearing my Wranglers. Because it's too snug up top.
So I'm supposed to wear it on the outside when we're Wranglers. Yeah. Not right. That leather holster.
Yeah.
What's up? Cowboys.
That's why they do
that. It's in the outside.
That's why
they do so that. You know right where it's at.
So that's why Gus and Woodrow never wore them on the inside. I know. Pants are too tight.
He's got a gun. How do you know? Because it's hanging right there by his knee.
Nathan, thanks for asking your question. If you guys want exclusive access to the show, bonus behind-the-scenes content, join us on Patreon. You got some awesome content you can get there. You got a whole community there. We got some cool swag for our Patreon community. That's the only place you can get it. Join us at patreon.com/teamneverquit. Let's get to the interview with Chris. First of all, welcome to the show, Chris. We're super excited to have you, man.
Yeah, excited to be on.
Okay, I'll start it out with this random question. How many chickens would it take to kill an elephant?
That's a lot of pecking, let me tell you.
Yeah.
I think it's probably about 500 chickens to kill an elephant.
500. All right. Now we got the numbers out.
All right. What advice would you give yourself if you could go back and talk to yourself at age 13?
Holy shit.
That's what I would say to myself, too. Stay up.
You know, you always think that you can go back and try to improve things and live life a little better and avoid some of your mistakes. But I really don't want to avoid any of my mistakes or really do anything different because I wouldn't be here right now. So I think I'd probably just hang out and observe myself and never actually go say anything.
Stay the course. That's a good answer.
Yeah, you wouldn't end up where you were today if you tried doing that. All right, so I got a question because Marks and I both are covered in tats as well. So your body art, in my opinion, is strategically placed in the pain centers of the body, right underneath your chest and down through your spine. I'm curious if you put those specifically there because of your love of pain.
that is a good question. I picked some pretty nasty spots, rib cage and sternum and
spine.
Spine, my armpits, you know, like inside my underarm, all that stuff. Like, I don't know. It just had to go there.
Which one got your attention the most?
Well, the Ouroboros took about 40 hours, and I did that in four straight sittings.
And that's where?
So that covers my entire upper body. So that's the one that covers the starts goes across my chest, sternum, yeah. under my pecs, inside my armpits, under my arm, like all that. And that one got me probably the worst because I was sitting for 8 or 9 hour sessions of getting those areas done. So it wasn't just like a couple hours of hitting the rib cage under the arms. It was 8-9 hours and then come back the next day and do the same thing and the next day and do the same thing till it was done. It was strategically placed, but it was so that I look like a Viking king when I'm shirtless on camera, which I happen to be a lot. So,
I remember I was watching some of your videos and I just remember thinking I was front sight focused because I have a spine. Marks and I both have spinal tats and, I remember walking in there one day and sitting down, and he hit my back with that gun. I was like, I'll come back next
2 seconds.
Week. I'll come back.
He's like, I'm not. I mean, sometimes you're just not feeling it.
I'm not in the mood.
Man, when they started going on my right arm went in the well, right there in the crease of the elbow, yep. I was like, hey. And then on my forearm, when I was getting the Red Horseman, man, that thing swelled up, and I was like, oh.
But I mean, As big as you are still, man, underneath your chest.
Underneath the chest, God. Right on the rib, right, yes. Across, because there's nothing there. There's right. Nothing. Like that needle feels like it's going through your rib cage. Yeah, right on the bone. And the other one of my armpits, I had two pec reattached. And so there's massive scar tissue. And we literally went like hours, like all over the scar tissue that's in my armpit. Like that was no fun.
Yeah, I got one of them too, boy. Back in the day, it probably had tattoos started coming up to cover scars, right? Because people thought scars, you know.
All right, we may circle back to the tattoos again, just because I find that interesting.
All right, brother, what do you like to do when you're not doing nothing?
I'm never not doing nothing, so
I got that problem too, man. That's why I was asking you. I was like, hey, man, I'm still not doing nothing. What do you do?
When I'm not lifting weights and spending time with my family, I really love either building my four-wheel drive rigs or getting out in the mountains and wheeling. But unfortunately, I haven't done much of that in the last few years. So I am almost done with my next off-road build. So pretty excited about getting move on that again.
That's awesome. You rock climbing or is it just straight mud?
I prefer rock climbing. You know, it's a lot more technical.
Buddy, yeah.
A lot more damage can be done to your rig, unfortunately, too. But the one I'm building right now is pretty epic. It's 40. It's got 47 inch tires on.
Whoa.
Four wheel steering. Two full steering systems. Central tire inflation. Custom unibog axles. So the lowest point of the vehicle is like as high as my knee. Four doors, front and rear AC, tunes, all that. All, you know, so it's nice and comfortable too at the same time.
Right.
But it's designed. It'll bomb through the desert doing Baja type stuff at 100 miles an hour, or you can switch to doing the most intense rock crawling around with it. So it's a very, very unique build. And I built it four doors with the amenities so I can take my whole family on doing trail rides and stuff like that as well. Or more epically, dropping my kids off at school in the ultra-liberal Portland schools. So
no question on who's rolling up.
That'll be entertaining.
what kind of chassis did you say you had on it?
It's a Dodge Durango chassis. Sounds a little odd until you see. I built a tubing roller to make the exo cage in. It's got an exo cage and an internal cage, but it's got these beautiful swooping lines that I was able to do with that, and it fit the body really well. There's a build on Instagram just for it, so you can check it out. Duffin's War Rig is what it's called, but it's pretty one of a kind. I'll put it that way.
I'm sure all of that building lends itself to the degrees that you have. You got it, and you stood. All right, I was unclear on it. You in the aerospace career field? How did that? I mean, not to jump ahead and jump around. That popped into my head, so I want to ask you right now. You have an aerospace background, correct?
Aerospace, automotive, and high tech is where I spent most of my industry experience.
Oh, so you're one of them underachievers.
Yeah, being average.
So, oh, okay.
Just average dude.
So I pursued a dual engineering degree and an MBA, and then ended up coming in and developing on the leadership front, and then running a lot of those companies, doing turnarounds, things like that. And engineering reported up through me as well. And so everywhere I've worked has been a pretty highly engineered environment. But automotive, aerospace, and high tech were like where I spent most of that 18 years I spent in that world.
Well, let's back it up a little bit. A lot of people come here because we all go through the hard times, and just the person going through it, the situation may present itself similar. But I mean, we all kind of got to go through these tough times. I mean, how when you were born, how'd you start out? Like, tell us a little bit about your family.
Well, I was, my parents were very intelligent individuals, and they just didn't want to be, particularly my mom, want to be part of society. So this is kind of coming out of the 60s, early 70s, and then I was born in the late 70s, where there was a group of people, it was just north of San Francisco area. And my mom just, we ended up just living in the mountains. And so, you know, living in tents, living in some condemned buildings, or, you know, a house that hasn't been finished yet, foraging for food, killing animals, you know, the type of homelessness where you're filling up a gallon jug of water down by a stream so you can set it on a rock during the day so it'll warm up so you can dump it over your head to bathe. I start off my book kind of with the story of like me at 6 years old, I was being taught how to catch, handle, and kill rattlesnakes by myself. 6 years old, you know, I'm sitting here with live rattlesnake wrapped around my wrist, staring into its face. But it was important. It was important that I knew how to do it, knew how to control my fear, because there was rattlesnake dens all over, and we lived our beds were beams lashed into the trees, and we had the bedding up on that so that snakes couldn't get up there at night. And that's the type of, you know, upbringing that I had for most of my younger years. When you're in those types of environments, man, the other people trying to escape from society, usually there's reasons there for some of them.
Sure.
So you run into lots of drug abuse, drug running, certainly, which that's kind of what my parents were involved with. Murderers, dealt with a serial killer, human trafficking, like all sorts of really fucking nasty shit when I was growing up. The state ended up taking us for a while, and then, which was definitely not a pleasant experience, you know, just getting ripped away from your siblings. I had three younger sisters and a younger brother and your parents, and stuffed into a home somewhere that you have no idea who these people are and no contact with anyone in your family is, I would say not particularly enjoyable experience, especially when you're like young and people, you know, your friends or family members have kind of died around you and you're still like trying to process some of that. But my parents ended up getting me back, or all of us back, except for my brother. And we end up in Oregon, and they decided to, growing weed was no longer the option. We quickly fell back into mountain living, either logging, then eventually independent mining. And so same thing. And finally by like high school, my stepfather won this disability case, and he was able to get a down payment on a mobile home, which was like this major event in our life. Now, mind you, the mobile home when we moved out was burnt down by the fire department because it was unlivable. But for us, it was amazing. Like electricity, running water. It may not have had doors. It didn't have a kitchen. You know, it didn't have stuff like that. So we took some 2x4s and framed up a sink so we could have, you know, something of a kitchen, and brought in a stove. But I had like this really stable environment ish through high school, as far at least a living. You know, I wasn't no longer living in a trailer down by the river or sleeping in the back of a truck, you know, with a foot of snow on the ground type experience for me that I dealt with a lot of the time leading up to this point.
So did you go to school, or did you just educate out in the field?
I went to school. So these were a lot of really small communities. You know, some of the areas I went to, you know, I had a class of like three people. But schooling was really important, and so was reading. So we did a lot of, like I said, my parents were really intelligent, really well-read. My father was a member of Mensa. My stepfather was really highly intelligent, well-read as well. And like that was our thing. We would go to the library like once every month or 2 months. We'd go into the big town, whatever was closest, and just get stacks of books about everything that we could find, and, you know, sit there either by candlelight or flashlight at night, you know, reading late into the night. And so it was a lot of mixture of both. I found school really easy. I guess that was a good thing. So I ended up getting a full ride. I was really good at sports as well. I was supposed to go to college as a wrestler, but I ended up getting a full ride scholarship for just academics only to go to engineering school. And I decided that might be the best option for me, since, you know, I had no financial resources and I knew wrestling wouldn't really lead to anything like, you know, something that I could rely on for the rest of my life. So I made that decision.
Jesus. Yeah, see that one coming.
When you come up, grow up. I was okay. All right, right on.
I don't know if I missed it. How old were you when you guys finally got into the trailer house, and then how long did that last?
Got into the trailer house basically my first year in high school, and so that. So I was there for 4 years. Then I moved out to go to college, and
living in a dormitory. I mean, you finally probably have your own bed for the first time and then able to take a hot shower. That's got to be mind-blowing.
I couldn't stand it, actually. I moved out.
Why?
I moved out of the dorm the first term. I don't know. It was too many people. It was too much going on.
Oh, yeah.
So I got a roommate. I lived in a really cheap town. It was in Klamath Falls, Oregon, so really low cost of living where I was going to school. And I moved out, got a small place, and did that. I also was not really highly engaged in college, I guess you would say. I found it just super easy. And so I ended up starting to work full time and kind of focused on just like my life and work, and school kind of rode in the background, even though that was supposed to be the primary thing that I was doing. But unfortunately, like, things fell into worse shape at home. Like, my mom had a mental breakdown, ended up out in Montana, and my stepfather, he wasn't really capable of really taking care of himself, let alone his three daughters. And so they ended up basically being on the streets or in care. And before I was finished with school, I ended up having to start take custody of them one at a time. So, you know, here I am, 21 years old. I've got custody of one of my sisters. I bought my own house. I was working on my second engineering degree. I was working full time as a I started actually in the windows and door field. I was running a third of this manufacturing plant. Had about 100 employees and three managers working under me. So I had a lot going on at that point in time. And then I end up I finally picked up stakes and moved to Portland, Oregon, so I could pursue my MBA, and that's where I took custody of my second two siblings, and so I ended up raising my three sisters through all of their teenage years while I kind of got started with my career, finished up my education, and that was my life.
Did your parents what kind of direction did they push y'all in? I mean, I know the education was important. It sounds like that's kind of in your DNA. Just getting in there and reading and decoding it. I mean, did they say, hey, we're doing the engineering thing, or did they just free will?
I never really had much of a direction. I was expected to do well in school. And that was just kind of an unwritten rule. But here's an example. There was one time I was in fifth grade, and my mom comes to me and she says, hey, do you have any interest in going to church? And I'm like, Oh, we're going to go to church. Okay. I'm like, yeah, sure. That sounds interesting. I'll find out about what's going on there. She's like, great. So she drives me to the church on Sunday and drops me off and leaves. And that goes on for about 6 months. And she, finally, she asked me, she's like, do you want to keep going to church? I'm like, nah, I think I learned what I needed to. I know what it's about. And she's like, good. I talked to her about this a few years ago, and she's like, oh, yeah. She's like, I just wanted to have you the experience, and so you could make a decision on your own about your own life, but literally gave me no direction, no push, like, you should go to church, you shouldn't go to church, you should – like, it was a prime example of kind of the parenting that I got, really, which was – I mean, there really wasn't much – direction. They expected me to go to, you know, go to college. I mean, I was valedictorian in my high school and, you know, a state level athlete. I was overachiever, right? But there was definitely not much beyond that, you know. mostly it was, you know, education around being true to your own morals, being true to yourself, like trying to do the right thing, but not really any much about like how to succeed in life. And honestly, they didn't know much about that. So I guess I don't really have anything else to say.
No, that's good.
Yeah, no, spot on.
What's the separation in your siblings age wise? And are they all still, I mean, what do they do? If you don't mind me asking.
Yeah. My brother, who's the one I wasn't able to have an influence on. So he's in San Quentin right now. Yeah, he's 3 years younger than me. My three sisters, who I did have an influence on, and was able to be involved in their life, and like I said, I ended up taking care of them. The oldest owns a resort in Central Oregon with her husband. It's kind of a lake and a, you know, camping and boating type thing. The second, she just had her first child, by the way, which was awesome.
Congratulations.
This last year. The one behind her is another year behind her. She lives in Central Oregon. She's just kind of floats around a little bit. I mean, she lives in the same town as my mom and helps my mom with her mining claim, and just really is all about, she's kind of like my mom and wanting to live an off-grid lifestyle. You know, she lives out in the middle of nowhere. Town's got a population of 100. It's an hour and a half to the nearest grocery store. You know, they have their own chickens and rabbits and a giant garden and just kind of live a very minimalist life. Her and her husband, and she just had her second child, which she, her first one was actually when she was living with me when she was 18, but, she's doing pretty well. And then the youngest, she's another, they're all a year apart. Her and her husband, they own their own businesses. So they've got basically a cleaning and maintenance business that they run. And so they work with some of the, in this resort town and manage the properties for the event hall where they put on music and some of the businesses around town and all that they take care of those facilities for those people.
So the one was a miner?
Yes. The second one's does mining.
That's hard work, man. So I mean,
that's great.
My sisters are hilarious. They're all these very tiny individuals. So, The tallest one I think is like 5'2", to give you a perspective. Like a picture of them next to me is funny, but they're country girls. They're beautiful women, but you go out in the mountains and they got a .44 on their hip and they'll outshoot anybody. And they go
awesome. Hunting.
And like it's pretty hilarious when I bring my farm boy friends out in the mountains and they meet them and they're like, "Holy cow! I went shooting with your sister. Don't ever mess with her." I'm like, "Yeah, I told you. And they're like, "I've never seen anybody like that." I'm like, that's my family.
And so hearing how you started out coming up, one of the reasons people come here is to hear our guest's greatest never quit stories. What's one of the hardest, what's your greatest never quit story if you coming up the way you did throughout your life? I mean, I got to hear that.
My greatest never quit story?
Yeah, the hardest you ever been hit.
It can be present day, or it can be, I mean, shouldering three siblings at the age of 21 in college has got to be one of the most memorable ones, but.
Or 1,700 pounds. That's on a squat rack.
I can't say that I really have, because that has been, I mean, I've been on my whole life. There's never been anywhere that I've got a fallback plan. You know, growing up, I really early on, I realized, hey, if I fail, like there's no couch at home I get to go crash on between jobs or anything like that. Like I'm out there on my own, no matter what the heck I do. And I've got to pull this off and I got to make it happen. There is not one major event. Like it's just a continuum in my life of being able to push, because it's, like I said, I grew up homeless to being, you know, turning out to be, you know, this corporate executive who was sought after, brought in to like turn around and sell companies and grow them from a regional to a national to international presence or something of that nature. Like that's a huge scope. And then like in my late 30s to just walk away from that and say, hey, I'm going to start a business from scratch, become an entrepreneur and do my own thing. And then, you know, that was 5 years ago, and I've got four businesses in my portfolio now. And starting that from scratch with nothing, that was a pretty tough time. I was actually going through a divorce in the middle of it. And I seek chaos, I guess. I seek the struggle, and I do not have one single story to share that really outshines any of the rest.
No, we've had people like the guests like that. That's their whole life is just one. I mean, it's not failure if you don't have anything to fall back to. So if you're just standing in the moment, and each one of those are designed to keep pushing yourself. I mean, never stop living, right? Seize the day. If every day is a brand new one, get after it.
Yep. I mean, just for example, like just the lifting side of it. I started lifting in 1988. I'm turning 43 here shortly. So I've been lifting for well over 30 years. I have so many like major injuries, nerve damage, muscles ripped off the bone. I'm currently missing a hamstring while I squat this 1,000 pounds regularly. And there's so many people that I've seen go by the wayside, like this new and up and coming person for, you know, and it's just like staying there and working through every battle, every injury, and still staying at the top of my game for that length of time. Like when I was competing in powerlifting, I was ranked number one in the world for 8 years straight in one discipline or another. And now I'm pulling off feats of strength and going for things that nobody has ever done ever before. I know I said ever twice, but whatever.
It drives the point home.
Yeah, I mean, life is a struggle. Carrying that, the weight you carried in the very beginning. I mean, you said you started working out in 1988. That doesn't sound like you started working out a lot earlier than that. Because the lifting that, to strap that much weight on your back and try to carry it around, I mean, that takes a determination and a grit that, what drives that? What are you telling yourself? Like what pops in that head?
Just fixing to ask you, what good Lord, what are you looking for?
I mean, that much weight. I mean, because like one of our guys, like David Goggins, man, he runs, and you're right, chaos is a real thing. In order for the good side to exist, the calamity and everything has to exist. There's people who live in that, and if you live in it long enough, it becomes a part of you, and you thrive in it, especially when it shows up. And
let me ask this: Do either of you guys go to the gym?
Yes,
every day.
And
not like you.
No. I'm not like that. Like what?
And going to the gym is stress. It's stress on your body, and you adapt and you get stronger. Right. What happens if you quit going to the gym?
You get weak.
You get soft. You get weak. The process of atrophy starts to kick in. This is the process that leads towards death. So the ability to take on challenging events in your life and come out a stronger and better person is, in fact, that is truly living. That is living to your potential. That's discovering yourself and knowing your limits, your capabilities, because unless you're testing yourself, you have no idea who you are.
True.
And you have no ability to grow as a human being unless you're challenging yourself.
That's right.
We only got one life. I say, fuck it. As humans, we're trying to find comfort. Comfort is the devil. Comfort is the process. That is when the decay and decline starts happening. Now, you do have to have rest. Just like if you go in and do 8 hours of CrossFit every day, 7 days a week, you're going to you're going to die. Like your body's going to fall apart, right? So it's a balance of those two. But you have to chase these things. So that's part of the message I try to drive home to people is, you know, we need to start looking somewhere else. You need to find the thing that makes your gut twist up in a knot with a little bit of like fear, anxiety, but also a little bit of excitement. Okay. It's just like, you know, the first time, you know, when you're younger, before you had, you know, your life partner and you're sitting there with your friends, you're like, God, there's somebody over there I want to go talk to, or, hey, I'm dating somebody and I'm scared of where this is going, but you want to live it. You want to grow. And at some point in our lives, we kind of fall away from that. But those are the things that change your life that really bring living to the forefront. And it is, I mean, I'm making a philosophical argument, but I'm not. This is a proven fact. As human beings, we only grow and adapt to stress. physical, mental, emotional, what have you. And if we don't have that stress to adapt to, we get soft. We get soft physically, we get soft mentally, we get soft emotionally. So I proposition that people need to find those things that they're afraid of and chase those things. You need to practice being in this state, because guess what? Life's going to come at you regardless anyway, okay? And something major is going to happen, and you're not going to be mentally or emotionally or physically prepared for it. It could be your father dying. It could be you getting sideswiped by a car and losing a leg. It could be any number of things. Think about people that you've known that something like that's happened to, and they freeze up. They lock down, and they're completely unable to like make decisions and move forward because they're not used to being able to respond in that environment because they haven't been testing themselves.
I don't care how old you are. If you get into a situation for the first time, you're going to respond like a child. It's just the way it is. And that Mojo, when I talk about that in the beginning, the fear lets you know that you're supposed to go. You're not trained for it yet. And even some of the guys, like the fighters and everybody, are like, man, I've been doing this for how like up 10 years, and I still get that same fear when I'm going out. I was like, well, it's actually anxiousness. The body responds. It's ready to go. Like the first punch is thrown, man. It's that fuel. I mean, if you have a race car frame and you start to drive it like a minivan, it'll fall apart. I mean, there's some of us that go so hard and that will go. I mean, we just go into it that we're designed that way. And the minute you kind of try to come off of that, things starts falling apart.
Yep.
Exactly. I like the way you said, I'm going to pawn this one off as my own. I'm just going to say that the only time that you're ever in your comfort zone is when you're sleeping. I just created a one-liner. I'm going to use that for the rest of my life. The only time I'm in my comfort zone is when I'm asleep. Otherwise, I'm not working hard enough.
So you know, that's kind of, I mean, there's a lot of, like my book covers a lot of ground, and there's a framework in it for helping people really dive deep and really understand like their values, how to set goals, and then how to like, you know, incorporate that in your life. It's very much a practical piece. But one of the big pieces of it is really pushing people to help them understand that those challenges and obstacles in their life are not necessarily a bad thing. And in fact, you should actually at times be seeking to find those things.
Sure. Absolutely.
Well, it's your individual game. I mean, when you start any game, you come in, you know, butt neck, you don't have anything. And as you go through life, you pick up all those little treasures and pieces and puzzle pieces, and those are your friends and everything that goes with it. And I mean, it is. It's a journey.
I got a question for you, brother. Hey, weightlifting for us went from a way of life to a part of life after we got out of the SEAL teams. You know, I don't really kick myself in the ass like I used to, but you continue to do that. And I know that in order to get to where you are at your level, you nobody can come in their first year and do that. It takes a lifetime of that struggle, if you will. At what point and at what weight was there a transition, you think? They're like, I'm going all the way. Because I can't imagine what that pressure feels like. And if you could explain that to our audience, what that feels like to have that much weight, either you're pushing it or you're squatting it or lifting it. What is that like?
Yeah. So it was 4 years ago. I had been competing in powerlifting for about 16 years. And that's when I was making a lot of changes in my life and really trying to align things with what my values were. And the sport of powerlifting just wasn't bringing, I was doing it because I had to, or I was expected to, basically not had to, but it wasn't for me. It wasn't fun anymore. And that's when I said, you know what, I'm going to step away from that and I'm going to create my own things that I'm going to do that allow me to express myself in that arena. Okay. And I said, I'm going to pick some crazy goals, and I called it grand goals. And I put a list in my phone of these goals, and I've been knocking them out one by one. But the biggest piece of that, was what I'm currently doing. And that was to be the first and only person in the world to squat and deadlift 1,000 pounds. Okay. People have done it individually, but nobody has been able to do both. And then I said, I'm going to take it a step further. Not only am I going to do it, but I'm going to do it for reps.
Three reps, right?
And so I did that for 3 years ago. I accomplished the deadlift portion, and now I'm chasing the squat portion.
Congratulations, by the way.
And the training that I – thank you. The training that I have to do for it, because, again, the I said people have done these individually. These guys weigh – five other people have done the deadlift over 1,000 pounds. Nobody else – well, somebody finally just did a double with it. Thor or Hafnor, the mountain from Game of Thrones – He just did 1,000 for a double, so that makes him the second person now. But all these guys are 380 to 440 pounds.
Did he do that at the Arnold Classic this year?
No, that was in training.
Oh, okay.
He just did it a couple weeks ago.
Oh, shit. All right. Nice.
And so he's training to try to beat Eddie Hall's 1,100 at the Arnold Classic, which is coming up in a couple weeks. So I don't know how to explain like what it's like to be under that load, but I am training with like such a heavy weight so frequently. Nobody else has ever done this before because I have to do that because I just don't have this giant frame to work off of. I have to train more to accomplish it. So right now I'm averaging out 30 repetitions per month over 900 pounds. And it is such a demanding toll. I'm down to – that's all I do is squat once a week. And, like, there's no accessories. There's no other stuff. And the entire rest of the week is dedicated to rehab and getting me prepared. And if I'm not on point for one of those squats, I'll get under that bar and I'll pass out with it on my back. I'll go completely blank. It happens. And I have no way of articulating how brutal the training that I'm doing right now is. I just don't even know. There's just no framework for me to explain.
To put it into perspective for somebody.
What I'm going in.
Yeah.
But it leaves me like completely mentally and emotionally, like it's incredibly emotionally draining. Like which you'd never think.
Can you do me a huge favor one day when you're doing this? I want you to take a blood sample before you get under the rack. And then in the other arm, after you come out, I want to take another blood sample and I want to do a comparative analysis to see what that, or have you done that?
I haven't done that, no.
Just to see what your body and how much of a different neural steroids, vitamins are in, blood cell count, testosterone, estrogen, cortisol, the whole stress, just to see what that looks like.
Yeah,
I'm a zombie. I'm a zombie for days after this. And, you know, sometimes if I get just slightly out of position, I may not be able to walk or stand for days afterwards as well. To the point of like excruciate. Most people would think they're done with their lifting career or need to go to the hospital or whatever it is. Unfortunately, I'm known on the rehab side, you know, particularly around spinal mechanics and recovery. I work with the best people in the world and I know how to get out of that state, but it doesn't mean it's not a pain in the ass
right.
When you're in the moment and you're like, fuck, am I even doing this anymore? Is this the one that's going to be the one I can't get back from? And, my daughter, you know, she's been around the last few sessions and she's like, I don't watch you lift, daddy. And I'm like, why is that? She's like, I'm afraid you're going to hurt yourself like the time you lost your ability to walk, which I did. I got in a walker, had to do a full rehab. But I'm like, don't worry, baby. Like, I always fix myself.
I already did that one. I mean, unbelievable.
But it brings it home when your kid is like, hey, you're scaring me. Can you please stop? Like, so... yeah, it definitely brings that home. That makes that stuff hard.
Well, man, putting that much weight on your back, and you're saying that you kind of got a euphoric zombie, it's like a Twilight Zone. Like, you're literally stepping into a world doesn't exist. With that much weight on a human, like with us, when we go in the beginning in training, they'll put an empty pistol in our hand, empty mag, everything. And then we just have to do these drills over and over again to where you don't even notice it in your hand. I mean, we're born, you can't even lift 1 pound. So, and then after we have the empty one and we get used to it, then they'll put a mag in there, and then they'll put some bullets in there. And so when you pull that thing, your body's so used to it, it doesn't wear down. My question is, when you're lifting this much weight, do you do it a pound at a time to where your body doesn't even notice it and you climb, like a slow progression? Or do you just kind of just throw hundreds of pounds on there and lift till it gets used to it?
Well, this has been over 30 years in the making. So.
That's what I'm saying.
And the specific training plan to get to where I'm at right now started 4 years ago. And the date was set for the final attempt a year ago. And we laid out the training towards that. Now, it's not exactly like the same movement, the same whatever, because there's a lot of stuff in the science of, you know, how we adapt, what type of, you know, movement selections we've got, what qualities that we need to develop. And so I follow a periodization approach, which is not just like changing sets and reps, by the way, but, you know, very far out. So a year ago, we were looking at what type of qualities I need to be able to maintain spinal stability, particularly at the thoracic junction and lower lumbar. So a lot of movements really focusing on that, really developing that. And then the next training block, we're trying to maintain that while we're trying to develop the next set of qualities. And then I was squatting, obviously, but doing different variations, because if you just squat all the time, at some point you'll quit. If you do the same movement forever, you'll quit getting the same amount of adaptive response. So it's really taking movements that are very far away from that. And then as we get closer to the actual event, it becomes more and more specific to what I'm doing. So right now I'm to the point of 100% specificity. But yeah, so every session we're looking at my average load, and we're trying to bring it up another 5 pounds over the last time.
So you're 30 pounds a year for 30 years, gets you around 1,000 point. That's your average, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
You started lifting in 88. We were 10 or 11 years old then.
But you're not at that strength all the time, right?
No, so, that's your max effort. Like, if you have to explode, you can push that. Like, your body, once you go under that pressure and your body feels it, I mean, if it hits, if you put that on there again, it's got to know that what that is.
It's not quite like that. So it doesn't mean, because 3 years ago I was a 500-pound squatter, let's say. I'm just picking numbers. And I do a bunch of stuff and I'm still training, I could still go in and squat that much. It's completely relative to your training at the time. So I had been doing a lot of deadlifting leading into this, and I hadn't actually squatted for like a year and a half. And then, but deadlifting is the same. It's an axial load. It's a top to bottom load of the spine. So it's going to cut over really well. But the first time that I would max, I might only be able to do 850 pounds.
Only?
Yeah, that's not only, good. Yeah. But it's not. But then over being very specific for a month, rapidly that goes from 850 to 950, and then continues to go up. So it's, but I wouldn't be able to do that if I didn't have the background stuff built. But it's not like any day I could walk in and max out at close to those weights. Like, I still have to have a training plan to maximize it and get it there.
Sure,
pattern, there's a lot, right? Neurological adaptation, other stuff that's going on, not just muscles getting bigger and stronger. Like, most of my training at this point is neurological based, over like adding, like, I've been training for over 30 years. I'm not going to put on 30 pounds of muscle, you know, this year. I might put on a couple, like two or three.
What about your muscle density? So the longer you've been doing this, and you can carry that weight, because it's just like steel. I mean, you keep hitting the body harder and harder. I mean, throughout the years, it gets harder. I mean, it gets stronger and stronger. Yeah. So you're dense.
It does.
I mean, most guys, when they go in there and they in the gym, like the bodybuilders, they lift real heavy weights real fast. That's why they balloon up like that. Over time, you keep with that steady flow pattern, man, it gets dense. Like, you're just gets so compact, yes, and yes, tight. And yes, then when you come off that 1,000 pound for a little while, which you should, right? I mean, it's kind of like your race car frame. I mean, we were, Morgan and I were watching that Ford versus Ferrari, and they put Ken in there, man. He would drive, he could tell you every single thing that was going on with the body and what it could take. You push that 7,000 RPMs, there's a bliss, right? Mm-hmm. And with the weightlifting, if you come off of that weight and you're wanting to get back to it, it's like climbing down the mountain. You got to climb back up it. You can't skip that part. You got to, but no. The climb is, the body remembers it. Something like that?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, once you've climbed that mountain, you can climb it a lot faster the next time around, but you're not just going to go, hey, I hit that peak. I'm going to walk in a year later and be able to just start at the peak and go to the next height. You know, you still got to climb up. It may be a sprint that next time. And then you're at that same starting point, and now it's like, hey, can I go up from there?
That's awesome way to explain it. Thank you.
Okay, let's shift gears. I got a question. I'm gonna shift gears on you. You got to where you are today, and your success, and your drive, and your motivations all predicated off of how you grew up. Is that an honest assessment?
You know, it's interesting because a lot of the people that I knew are all either dead, in prison, or drug addicts that were around me. So you can't say because I was put in that environment, I came out this way. But without a doubt, those things I did use to fuel, you know, the drive that I needed to be where I'm at in life. So, but you also, so yes, but also not, it's not a definitive, like, hey, you throw everybody in a rough environment, they're going to come out great. It doesn't necessarily work that way, right? Usually it's the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other end of things, I don't want anybody to really feel that, oh, you've got to have this crazy backstory or whatever to accomplish amazing feats. At the end of the day, it's the choice of who we are right now today. Like, this is, you have the choice in your actions. You're not defined. Like, your past doesn't create you. The environment that you're surrounded in, these all have an influence, but at the end of the day, if you know, you could have horrific things happen to you. And a lot of people will identify themselves this way. You talk to somebody and you ask them who they are, and they'll tell you about, I'm this way because I had alcoholic parents, or I'm the guy that's got a bad back and I'm going to be in pain for the rest of my life. And these are kind of like self-fulfilling prophecies, because those are things that happen to you. They're not who you are. And your identity is formed by your responses and the actions that you take, not the things that happen to you that you don't have control over. And really separating that, I think, is an important thing. And I like to make that distinction, because it's like, well, I could never do that because I've never had this, like, the same background as you. Or the other side of it is a lot of people being pity parties. Look at me, I can't do this because of this and this and this. And they use that to create their identity instead of, like, that is not you. Like, get up and, you know, you decide what you're going to do with your life. And we've got that decision every single day.
It's well said.
Yep. I try to explain it to my kid, like, hey, look, it's like for when you're playing your video game, at the end of when you get done, you get to save the game. So at the end of the day, you save the day. So when you wake up, you get your starting point. If you don't learn anything as you're going through your day, you'll always start at the repeat cycle. When you wake up in the morning, I mean, everything you need is probably going to be around you to get through it. It is. The pity part is the worst. Like, hey, man, I couldn't do this because, you know, I got thrown this hand. Well, you know, that's like the way it is with anything. I mean, driving down the road in your truck, something breaks the window or you get a dent in it. That's just, man, there's no reason I can't drive my truck. It's got a dent in the door. Man, I just don't want to wash it. You know, my brother and I, like, that's our vehicles. It's like, man, it just takes the functionality away from it, but at no point in time should it stop you.
For all the parents out there, how do you, what are you telling your little ones?
I've got a tattoo, or two tattoos.
Yeah, we know.
and the first one is the eagle. And so that's the first half of the book. And I had this done about 20 years old. So walking away from these really kind of crazy traumatic experiences through my upbringing, and there's an eagle, and it's one of them's across my stomach trying to take flight, the other one's across my back trying to take flight. But each of them around their ankle is a little shackle and a chain. And then that chain, if you follow it, goes all the way down to my ankle. And I had this tattoo done at 19, 20 years old, this big 40-hour piece, with the whole message behind it being, you can fly to whatever heights that you want in this world. The only thing holding yourself back at the end of the day is yourself.
Yep.
It's for people to understand. And it's really hard to for some people to see that. That's what that first half of the book about is separating your identity from your environment and the things that have happened to you to creating your own identity through your actions and decisions. And that process of really finding your and discovering your strengths.
That's pretty powerful, bro.
Yeah. When you said that, I was like, hey man, you got you got two eagles on you trying to take flight. And then you had to anchor yourself down to the ground so you didn't take off. I mean, because sometimes you put somebody as, and there's a difference between educated and your intelligence. I mean, like everything's kind of coded in there. And as you read stuff throughout life, it kind of decodes it, if you will. Some people who are born with that intelligence, they're also tapped with the lazy side of it. And then like with you getting thrown into that environment, that had to have created you. You said you wouldn't change anything. That's absolutely right. You shouldn't.
I wouldn't. Like I look back, like it's funny. I didn't really start having these reflections until I had children myself. And I'm sitting there watching my kids grow up and I'm looking at them at the age they are. And then I'm thinking about the experiences that I was going through at that same age. And I'm like, holy shit. Okay. That was some pretty wild things that I was experiencing at that time. And it really, like, then thinking about my kids having to be in that environment was just incredibly saddening to me.
Yeah.
Like thinking about that. Yet at the same time, when I think about my life, I'd be like, man, I would not change a damn thing about it.
Yeah.
Because it has given me such this scope of ability to look at things because it's a rarity. Like it's not, my life's not worse than everybody else's or anything. We all have our own challenges and trauma, but I've definitely been able to see a lot more scope or breadth in life than most people would from the experiences that I've had. And I'm like, that's really made me who I am in combination with a lot of introspection during the course of it. But while we're talking about, I'll finish the discussion on tattoos. So the second half of the book is the dragon. And so my second tattoo, it's another one, takes about, I spent 40 hours, I said, under the needle on that one, is a giant Ouroboros. There's a giant dragon on my chest, and his body wraps around my back and my arms and shoulders and comes back around, and his tail is in his mouth, and he's eating it. He's eating himself. It's a mythology for the continual renewal of life, rebirth, infinity, a lot of different meanings. To me, it means the purposeful reinvention of oneself. It is specifically, so it's not about like discovering your identity and finding your strength. It is specifically deciding, who do I want to be in this world? And becoming that person. How do I want to impact the world? Becoming that person. And that's what the second half of the book is, because here I am, I find myself at one point, you know, I had this crazy upbringing and I wanted to prove to the world, hey, I could be a normal, successful individual. So I got a great job. I performed really well. At the time I was working in the automotive world and living in a house with a white picket fence. I'm married. I got two kids. I'm like, I've made the American dream. And I look around, I'm like, but was it my dream? Like, it's not. I'm like, I'm missing something. I feel like stabbing myself in the eye every fucking day because I'm bored out of my mind. I'm not doing in the world what I want to be doing. And that's when I threw everything. I walked away from an extremely high-paying, secure career where I was sought after to, like, put my life savings on the line and walked away from all of that to reform and recreate who and what I want to be and how I want to be impacting the world. And you know, I'm still in the midst of chaos and strife with, you know, starting up businesses with, you know, literally no backing and getting them launched and out there. And but in 4 years, like, I've penetrated nearly every major, you know, sport, definitely in America, if not the world, working with 500 different colleges. You name a pro team or a college team, like, we're working with them. I work with 90% of the top MLB teams. Like, in just a matter of years, we're getting people healthier and better prepared and more resilient and reducing injury rates across the spectrum. NBA, NFL, NHL, heck, David Beckham's soccer team just bought our stuff, like Tour de France, Olympic training center, like everywhere. We're everywhere. This is specifically what I want to do in recreating it. I'm remarried to an amazing woman. I've got a third child now, and my life is filled with stress every day financially, with like all the business startups and everything going on and the chaos. And I couldn't be happier. I have every day I'm able to show my kids that when they grow up, that they can take the world and form it around themselves and live it the way that they want as well. I don't have to have them read a book. I don't have to tell them a story. I show them it with my life every day. I've got love at home. I've got a team that I couldn't, like, every part of what I'm doing, every part of my life is aligned. And I couldn't be in a happier place because of it.
It's awesome, man.
But I mean, your life kind of denotes that. Talking about that dragon, when it eats itself, when you shed your skin, like, you're not walking away from your career because you made that career. And you, every time you shed your skin, I mean, you come out, it's going to be soft, right? But then you just keep going, and everything just keeps falling on. The pressure is because everybody around you trying to get closer and closer and closer. And, but I mean, you're spinning so fast, that, and you've been doing this, that's the thing. A lot of the younger versions and everybody around you, that's how that works. So, I mean, as soon as that dragon and you gets done eating itself and shed that skin, and you got those eagles waiting to take off, they got to keep your ass anchored to the ground with 1,700 pounds on your shoulders. I mean, that's how freaking hard you go. That's awesome.
Yep. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show today and sharing just a little bit of your story. If you'd like, would you like to plug your company, your book, everything you've got going on right now?
Yeah. My main company is Kabuki Strength. That's K-A-B-U-K-I strength.com. My other businesses, Build Fast Formula, Performance Supplements, and Barefoot Athletics, the human-to-ground interface, are also out there. An easy place to find those is also where you can find my book, which also you can get a free audio download of my book for an Audible account. And I've got all the information on that on my personal website. And there's links to all the businesses as well. But that's ChristopherDuffin.com. ChristopherDuffin.com. I'm all over social media. You can probably find me anywhere. Just type my name in to platforms. The ones that I interact on are Instagram and LinkedIn. So that's where you'll find most stuff. I really don't do anything on Facebook. I'm trying to figure out TikTok and some of the other medium, but Instagram, LinkedIn, that's where most everything's at. We've got a pretty extensive YouTube channel as well that's been around for a long time. So like I said, you type in Chris Duffin anywhere or go to the websites, you'll find links to it.
So what's your next thing you got coming up?
I am, so March 19th, I will be squatting 1,000 pounds, hopefully for somewhere between 3 to 5 reps at the San Diego Convention Center.
Jesus Christ.
I know, right?
So,
three to five reps.
Why are you doing that? That just makes my muscles hurt thinking about it.
So that'll be March 19th at the San Diego Convention Center. And this is my big last final feat of strength. And what do you do after that? Like,
oh, you'll find something to do. I imagine
a lot.
Yeah, man. I'm sure you'll be finding something to do. We'll be there watching. Yeah, that's awesome, man. Thank you so much for coming on here and sharing a little bit about yourself. And I learned a lot, like we always do, man. The that perspective and some of that wisdom you're dropping down is there for a reason, man. And everything you had to go through is for a reason to make you the man you are today. So yeah, man, God bless you, dude. Thank
sharing
you
sharing your childhood with us, that was powerful. God bless you.
And so, and I do want to throw this out there. Every one of these major feats of strength that I do, they're paired with a charity that I believe in and that we're raising funds for. So this most recent one is we're raising funds for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. My business partner's grandson battled that last year. And so that is something that so on the Kabuki Strength website, we've got Grand Goals shirts that we're selling. 100% of proceeds go to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Foundation or Society. And you can also just donate directly as well. So anyway, just want to throw that out
there. That makes sense. Yeah, who's asking you what that weight feels like to carry? And you said you couldn't describe it. Charity hurts. So thank you for carrying all that weight for all of them that are suffering. That's squared away, man.
And those people are truly like they're carrying the weight.
Yeah.
Know? That's yeah.
All right, brother. Have a great day.
Do the same.
Be good, buddy.
All right, guys, it's that time for a listener story of the day, and today's listener story is coming to you from Ethan. His story is Never Quit Every Day, Continually Improve. What's up, Team Never Quit? My name is Ethan, and I've been listening to your show for a little while, and I've been following Marcus for a while now. I read Lone Survivor back in 2013 and was super inspired. Your story and the Navy SEAL's way of life inspired me to have a change of mindset on things like bettering myself and striving for excellence in everything I do. I appreciate what you guys are doing here and love the message you portray in every episode. Mr. Luttrell, I've followed you for a while now, and the inspiration you've given me is huge. Everything you've been through and have done for this country and the people of this country is incredible. I want to thank you for being an inspiration to me and for sharing your story. My Never Quit story has been a part of my everyday life since I can even remember. I'm a person who stutters. Stuttering affects about 70 million of the worldwide population, which is about 1%. Most people understand stuttering to an extent, but I would like to go a little deeper. For me, stuttering is a part of every second of my life. Every time I open my mouth or think about what I'm going to say, it's there. Imagine simply trying to walk from one end of the room to the other and have to constantly avoid obstacles that continually present themselves. That's a dumbed-down version of what speaking is like for a person who stutters. It is a constant mental battle with yourself to gain confidence to say exactly what you want to say, to use the techniques that I've learned to be a fluent speaker and to be able to get out of my comfort zone and do what I fear. That last point is the main message of my Never Quit story. I'm 23 years old right now and started speech therapy when I was 9. At the beginning, I could barely get through a sentence without blocked speech. I was shy, held back my personality, and avoided doing things because of my stutter. Through the years, I noticed steady improvement in my speech, but it wasn't until high school that I took a major jump in my fluency. That jump was a major gain in confidence. This came from a newly found determination to better myself and to not be controlled by my stutter. I did not want to simply quit on something because of my speech. I didn't want to not do what I wanted to do because of my speech. And I realized that when I did things that made me uncomfortable, such as public speaking, or even as simple as raising my hand in class or making phone calls, that I grew so much. Every time I did something like this, I used things that I learned from my speech pathologist and continue to practice them every single day. My confidence in myself grew so much, and I believed that I could do things that at one time I did not. And once I got this idea, I never stopped. I kept challenging myself to get out of my comfort zone, to get to the limit, then go beyond the limit in order to grow and become a more fluent speaker. I never wanted to quit on anything anymore just because I'm the person who stutters. I ended up finding myself in positions that called for a lot of communication and speaking in front of people. In high school, I ended up being the captain of my rugby team, in which I played a position that constantly had to be vocal. Calling out plays, barking orders, communicating with the referees. And then I majored in business in college where I had to present to classes sometimes as big as 100 plus people. This idea of doing things I'm not comfortable with and that I feared transferred to other aspects of my life, whether it be from working out, playing sports, excelling in school, etc. I am driven to conquer the fear I had in things. I will never become a totally fluent speaker, and I know I'll always have room to improve in everything I do. I'll always stutter, and I will always struggle with doing the uncomfortable things in my life, but I will never quit. I remember reading Lone Survivor and reading phrases like, never quit, and the only easy day was yesterday, etc., and being inspired. I thought, this applies to me directly. When I finished the book, I realized that if you incredible guys can persevere through Hell Week, basically drown, come back to life, risk your lives for us and our country, put yourselves in the scariest places in the world, then I can beat the fear I had in myself. Keep doing what you're doing. You inspire so many people every day. Never quit, Ethan.
Well, that mantra resonates right here at home with this group.
Like,
and never say never. You said you never. Hey, that's, I mean, amazing story nonetheless. But never say that one day we will figure out how to cure stuttering.
I mean, I always think about your greatest strength is your greatest weakness down here, tapped with at birth. So as you're going through life, when you didn't speak, I bet you're a great listener. And a lot of times when people do a lot of talking, when the response needs to be only a few words. And I mean, Mojo and I had, our eyes were messed up growing up. You know, you get tapped something at birth that affects you when you're trying to introduce yourself to somebody.
Oh, my.
I mean, it's just like, what? Whatever. You know, if you got a stutter, man, just like, hey, he likes to take his time during his conversations. I mean, always look at it as a positive. And if somebody, your true friends will sit there and listen to you and talk until you get it out, until you go. And then you practice, and it's your biggest fear. And you put yourself in front of it. And then over time, man, it's just eventually what you're doing is you're capturing your voice.
I don't know at what point I actually became comfortable with looking people in the face when I have a conversation with them, because my eye would start wandering off. But you have to accept it like you did with your stuttering. And you just got to work hard to correct it.
That's personality. Correct it in ways. I'm trying to remember his exact words, but he's talking about perfect speech or exact speech. We talk, that doesn't even exist. I mean, country folks, they make fun of us for talking slow and using that. I don't even know, but it's all a rhythm. It's your vibration, man. And as you get that down and your confidence pushes that out, your tone gets created, and man, you never take a step back. Anybody who's tapped with something like that at birth, never look at it as a setback. Look at it as your training weight. And as you're pushing through it,
I would say you're doing the right thing. And I worked with one of the smartest individuals on the planet at the National Laboratories under the DOE. Literally one of the smartest men in when it came to artificial intelligence. And his stutter was so bad. It was almost hard. You couldn't understand, but it would take forever for him. And everyone, including the secretary, was sitting right there riveted on what he had to say, because even though his speech patterns were broken and slow, what he had, his output was so important, because nobody else could think like that.
Yeah. I mean, how many songs do you hear where you don't even know the words? You just know what was said affects you a certain way. And that's perfect, man. It's like, hey, man, they're not listening to how you say it. They're listening to what you're saying.
Thank you for sharing your story, buddy. God bless.
Never quit.
Yeah, if you want to share your story, head over to the website, teamneverquit.com/podcast. There's a share your story up in the navigation, and there you can read stories, you can submit your own story, you can encourage people that have shared their stories. I'm sure that there's someone there that's gone through something like you. We love it when you guys do that. All right, Marcus Morgan, what'd you think about today's interview with Chris?
I love it when he said, he's like, he hit the nail on the head when his philosophy about how you have to stress yourself, and his only time is not in his comfort zone is when he's sleeping, but he's a better person because of it. Yeah, that's great advice from start to finish. I mean, it's kind of hard with the adversity that he'd faced from a child till now.
I mean, people say they don't go work out. Life is a gym. The minute you get born into it, man, life is pressure and stress and mold you in a certain ways. Then you got people to go into the gym to get a little extra weight strapped onto them. But at no point in time are you going backwards. If you notice, every day that comes by, you grow bigger and stronger and faster. Even if you're just sitting there, you're still growing bigger and learning something. Otherwise, you couldn't function. It's just how far you want to take that each day. See how far you can run. See what you can get and who you can meet. And then next day, do it again. My childhood, man. Some of them guys that smart, man, they get tapped with a life like that. Like you said, they just won't do nothing. And then some of them, man, it just makes him. He's got that mind and body pressure.
Yeah, I like how he said that. You know, he didn't want to focus so much on his childhood just because of the fact that he wants people out there to know that, like, you don't have to have the worst childhood to be able to accomplish great things.
Yeah, he's surrounded by just adversity and evil. Is like, that doesn't define you. Doesn't make you who you are. You make your own choices. It's like, statistically, yeah, people spiral down that rabbit hole if they're surrounded by those things. And he's one that just happened to persevere, and and that lends itself to his ability to articulate his point and saying, hey, look, you know, everybody can be a victim.
That's right.
How many rabbit holes you go down where there wasn't somebody else in there? I mean, you know what I'm talking about? I mean, so it's like, hey, man, you guys teaming up. We're all down here. Let's just, and everybody sets their own rock bottom. How far you want to go down it.
That's exactly right.
I mean, what kid have you ever talked to who said he had an easy childhood? Yeah. It's all. Doesn't everybody have a hard one? It's, I mean, some are harder than the other. It's relative. That's perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, childhood's tough.
Exactly.
I mean, that's just the way it is.
Sucks for everyone a little bit differently.
Yeah, if you got an easy one, trust me, it's going to be hard when you get away from the parents.
That's right. Hey, guys, if you want to get access to the show, if you're not following us already, make sure you subscribe. You can subscribe on iTunes or any other major podcast player. You can press the purple subscribe button on Apple Podcasts, and you can get the show every single Wednesday into your phone, into your headphones, into your car speakers, into your home device, whatever, wherever you're listening to podcasts, we're there. If you're not following us on social media, we're at team_neverquit. Marcus is Marcus Luttrell. Morgan's Mojo Luttrell. I'm Andrew Brockenbush on Instagram. And if you don't have some sweet swag, some sweet merch, head over to the Team Never Quit shop. We've got some new hoodies. We've always got autographed books. We've got such a lineup of great cool gear. And like always, thanks for coming back every single week to listen to the podcast. We love it. Inspires us. Hope you guys love it too. Later.